Karen?
Coffee?
No, I'm fine. Great. Hi, everybody. My name's Ted. I'm an alcoholic. I guess I should say a grateful recovered alcoholic, because this is part of the journey. I met Karen at the front door when I was coming in, and it's odd that as I was coming down to this meeting here, I had to say the third step prayer a couple of times, because asking God to take away my defects of character, but my fixation, I guess, on self. One of the things that blocks me off a lot from the sunlight is getting places just on time. And because I totally lose my serenity. So there it was, I was at home this evening. I'd spent a day in the country. I drive home. I get there in lots of time, but I'm doing email. So having to disconnect from the computer and then get down here on time, you know, what a lesson. But at least, as I say, you know, I can be serene. I have some control over that now, whereas in the past I never did. Just another very quick story I was sharing at a prison meeting a couple of nights ago, and before we got up to the prison, I was at a particular coffee place that asks you to roll up the rim, and I had chucked my coffee into a waste paper basket, and this fellow says to me, well, you better check it out, see if you want anything, and I'm saying, well, ah. So I check it out, and sure enough, I've won a coffee. And I said, oh, the hell with that, because I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to this restaurant, and I'm going to get a coffee, which is the smallest, darkest, crappiest little coffee that they could make. Why? Because that's my expectation. And this fellow was telling me, he says, no, if you bought a large French vanilla, that's what you're going to get. So, in fact, that's what I had bought. But my expectation is always that I'm going to get the crappy little coffee, because it's my cultural background. I come from a culture which I would say goes to the ocean of God's grace with the expectation of filling a thimble. And I also know that I was born resentful, because I'm a twin, and I was a second twin, and I'm a breech birth. Actually, it's a breech extraction, because after my twin sister was born, I was luxuriating in the space for about 3 minutes before they went in with forceps and pulled me out. And bum first, which is about the last time I ever touched my toes like that. But years later, I spoke to my mother, and she says, well, you know, we understand now with twins that maybe the second twin could have stayed in there until the twin was kind of ready to be birthed. And so I look at this. There were other things that I look at in my childhood which were good indications that I had a problem. First off, my father, bless his heart, bless his soul, was a rageaholic. And when I was a child, I was born very small, and I was a small kid, believe it or not, but I was very, very frightened of this man, because I could be standing beside him one moment, and then I'd be laying at the base of the wall the next, and I didn't know what had happened. And I went through elementary school, and I got into a lot of trouble. I guess the first problem was that the principal that I had at this particular school was psychotic, and he used to give me the strap every day. Now, my dad figured if I'm getting the strap every day, I must deserve getting the strap, whereas my mother is saying, no, there's a problem with this man who's hitting my son all the time. And for me, it was just an excuse to act out. Now, I've learned as an adult that I have a problem with authority, so this was just another way for me to kind of start to build up resentments about people who were in authority positions. I was brought up in an Irish Catholic community, Irish priests, Holy Ghost fathers, Christian brothers, not that I need to mention their names, poor guys. And I also learned in that community that they have this expression, and maybe other people would be familiar with this, of spare the rod and spoil the child. And also that might makes right, and I'll explain that a little later. One of the things that I got a lot was a lot of authority from my father. And I try and get out from underneath. There were 7 kids in our family, and it just seemed that the dynamic that I had with my father, I was named after my father, which being a junior in a family, I also found to be not all that attractive. So here it is right away. The dynamic is kid against the father. And years later, I understand that my dad wasn't that much more mature than I was anyway, so it was like really just 2 kids. So The other thing that I realized was that when there was an authority figure in front of me and they were giving me the riot act and shaking their finger at me, I realized from a very early age that I have a particular talent with the muscles in my eyes, that I can kind of cross my eyes and make a person go like fractal, like a fly's eye kind of thing. There's multiple images of that person in front of me. So it was a way for me to escape reality from a very early age. Somebody would be standing there pointing down at me and telling me how it is, and I'd be looking at them and just, oh, well, that's very interesting, and they're over here and they're over there. Later on, I was to realize that that was just, another facet, I suppose, of heavy drinking. But from the time that I was a kid, I realized that I did not like reality. I did not like authority. And I understand now, as a recovered alcoholic, that these were traits which would haunt me. Through elementary school, I also realized that it was a lot easier to get attention by doing things which were wrong than it was to actually apply myself and work hard. So I became a bad boy from a very early age. One of the other problems, though, was that I was isolated. Even growing up in a family with lots of kids, I didn't spend time with my brother. My brother was a fellow who liked discipline. He ended up joining, he was a commando for 17 years, and he liked the military, and I tended to kind of go in an opposite direction. So I spent an awful lot of time alone as a child. And again, this is something that I understand, again, is a trait of us alcoholics, is our isolation. I tended to be off by myself doing things, whereas other people would be engaging with other kids playing games. Maybe it was not advantageous, but at about 12 years old, I was probably the size of somebody who would be, I guess at 12 years old, I was about 6'2" and about 150, 160 pounds, which is a pretty big 12-year-old. So I'd be playing hockey with guys who were my age, and they were half my size. So at the break, they'd say, hey, you get out of here because you're too rough. You body check, it's not fair playing against you. So then I'd go and I'd play hockey with the guys who were my size. We'd play a good game of hockey. But then at the break, they'd be talking about girls, and I couldn't relate. So either way, I felt like I was caught in between. So I just tended to spend more and more time away. And I knew also from a very early age that if I could say to you, give you this vision about how I felt was like a Hostess potato chip bag that was just filled with air. And it was so easy just to scrunch that bag right up because it was hollow. There was nothing in there. I had no sense of self. I had no I had no self-love. I mean, I've learned that later. And again, these are things that we learn even in the family. But I understand that my parents, who had divorced after 35 years of marriage, never had exhibited a lot of love in the family. As I say, my dad was somebody who was a rageaholic, so there was probably a lot more fear. As a child, I remember the relationship with my father was based on this. When my dad came home from work, I would hide in the back of the clothes closet. And if my dad, walking by the front door of the clothes closet, gave my mother a kiss, then I'd peel the coats back and I'd jump up and go, ta-da, and maybe get a Coffee Crisp chocolate bar or maybe a hug or something like that. But if my dad did not give my mother a kiss, then I stayed in behind the coats, didn't even step out. My dad would go upstairs and do his thing, and then I'd get out and I'd run away and, vanish. But that's the kind of relationship that I had, and I think I had that relationship even into my adulthood. So here again, these are the things that I look at now, which were patterns, which were indications that I had a problem. I went through high school, and I excelled at hurting other people playing sports. This was a place which I was allowed to take out my anger, my rage, my upset. Playing football was a particular place which it's legal to hurt somebody else on the field, and so I did a lot of that. I'm not proud about it now. I went through high school, and again, a lot of acting out. I began drinking, I guess my first drink just by accident, happened to be at about 8 years old when my dad had a poker game one Saturday night, and I'm around the table at Sunday morning. And I'm going around, there's this gray, flannel blanket on top of the table, and it's a table very much like this, and there's some poker chips that we now use for our 3 and our 6 and our 12-month celebrations, but in that case it was a poker game, and there's an ashtray and there's some old stogies in the ashtray, and there's a couple of old beer, And I take a look at one of these beer bottles, and I take the beer, and I have a sip of it. And it was skunky old beer from the night before. And I said, oh, I'm never going to drink that. And I didn't realize it, but my dad was around the corner in the kitchen. And I hear him say, oh, give it time. And how right he was, you know? How that he would know about that. And I think the first time that I'd taken alcohol, I was probably about 12, 13 years old. I think we were going out skating with some kids from, you know, from a church group. And I took some vodka that I'd found and put it into a beer bottle. So I don't know why I didn't just leave it in the bottle that it was in. It was a Mickey, which was 12 ounces, and I take it and put it in a beer bottle, which was 12 ounces. But, you know, go figure. And it became the center of my life from that point on. And the guys that I hung around with were also pilfering. They were stealing alcohol out of their dad's liquor cabinets in the basement. And we kind of get on our bicycles and go down to the park and sit in front of somebody's window, you know, watching inside their front room while we're sitting outside and getting drunk. And then these people call the police, and then we just go crazy and go peeling off through the park on our bicycles, young drunks on bikes, you know. Anyway, high school progressed. I finished high school, and again, part of the rebellious character, the anger, was that I had a certain relationship with the principal of the school. So the last day of school, when I had several football scholarships to my credit and I'd done very well in athletics, I decided that I was going to show this priest, and I took my school uniform and I bundled it up with the tie and I stuffed the pockets with toilet paper and I took lighter fluid and I soaked it, and then I knocked on the door of his office. He opens the door and I lit the jacket. So I'm burning the jacket and shaking it like incense, and this priest is just looking at it, and he's just like almost fainting. And I thought I got the last laugh. I thought this was very clever, you know, showing this priest what I thought. But in point of fact, what they did was they failed me in phys ed. Now, go figure. I mean, here it is. I had done very well in athletics, and there's no way that I failed phys ed. But it just shows you, you know, I can't remember at the moment what the adage is about he who laughs last laughs best or whatever, but I mean, they certainly got one over on me. I ended up going to summer school for a phys ed course. Anyway, this kind of resentment carried on. I can remember there were a lot of times, like many of us here, we had life opportunities which were presented, but I knew better than to take the advice from either people who were older, people who were more experienced. Why? Because I was going to do it my way. I knew better. Somehow I had a conduit, you know, I was connected. I've always been a spiritual person, but I don't think that I've listened to that spirit. There's always been this kind of hellion side. I went through all of high school, and I excelled in after-school sports and also after-school activities like drama and things like this. Anything that would keep me away from the house. Because, again, the dynamic that I had with the authority figure in my home was that my dad would be home for dinner, and I would be doing theater or basketball or football after school. So it means I would get home like 10, 11 o'clock at night, so I would never have to see my father. And this went on for years. This was the dynamic that we had. And this carried on also then professionally. I finished high school. I worked as a farm laborer in southwestern Ontario. And again, it was just an awful lot of drinking, and drugs are also part of the story there. Working as a laborer, harvesting tomatoes, apples, tobacco, whatever, living on the farm. And what was there to do? I mean, it's a place where you just did an awful lot of drinking. And it became the focus of what I would do also. I mean, I would plan my week, you know, from Monday to Friday. It was what we were going to do on Saturday. We'd have somebody go into town and get us, you know, maybe some drugs. We'd line up the booze. Of course, at that time, I was able to go and buy my alcohol legally. I'd been buying alcohol since I was 14 years old. I didn't have a preference for any particular kind of alcohol. I would drink anything. And I realized, again, after I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I look and I say, I had this insatiable thirst for alcohol. I couldn't just have a sip of it. I'd toss a glass back, and I'd be filling it again before I knew what was going on. And I just thought, well, it was because I'm a large person, and I'm thirsty. But it had nothing to do with thirst. It had to do with this physical addiction to alcohol and this mental obsession. And I would tie into that then also the cultural deprivation, which is to say, you know, coming from a rich cultural heritage with the expectation that I should not ever aspire to anything great because someone's only going to step on me and take it away anyway. Yeah, I think that's very much, you know, that's very much the kind of culture that I grew up in. I left this farm town. I had met a girl. She went to university, so I figured, what a finer way than to stay seeing this girl. I decided to go to university. And to make a long story short, that was 3 university degrees ago. I mean, I went to a lot of university. And I think twice it was because of girls that I met, and they were doing something, so I decided that I would go to school. So it was never really having a plan to say, okay, I'm going to go to university, get a degree, and do this kind of thing. It was, here, the girl is doing this, she's going to that school, so I'll go to this school and I'll get my degree. And I also found that studying in university was another way of avoiding reality. Because I got up to the level of having 3 degrees, 1 in my master's, and a lot of the professors that I would have at university were people who were not connected to reality. And I understand now as an alcoholic that I have a disease of perception. And these people that I sought out as companions also had diseases of perception, except that they got paid for it. It's called a tenured professor. And in this case, they could be in a university and they'd be there for 20 years not knowing anything about what's going on out in the real world. But, you know, and all the book work. So it was another way that I had of escaping reality. I moved to Toronto. I was working in work in Toronto, which involved alcohol. So oddly enough, I ended up finally being a manager at a big nightclub. And I like to think that I had 32 staff members at this nightclub, and that this is part of the story, as I say, which has to do with I acknowledge the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. But at this nightclub, I was quality control for the 32 staff members. Any marijuana that came into the club, any cocaine that came into the club, I had to sample it first because I wanted to make sure that my staff were going to be okay. When in fact what I was just a garbage pail and just a consumer. And just it was my way of welching off the pushers who would come into the club. So I also got all my alcohol free because that was just part of the deal. I'd walk through the club, there were 7 bars on the main floor, and there'd always be a bartender pushing a glass of orange juice out to the edge of the bar while I was doing my rounds. And in that glass of orange juice, it was probably 40-50% rum, just white rum, and the rest of it was orange juice for the vitamins, I guess. And a lot of denial then, too, because I just used to look at it, and at this time, there was kind of something coming together between my father and I, but he would call me up. I'd be getting in at 8 o'clock in the morning from a booze can or a blind pig, and he'd say, well, where have you been? I said, well, I'm just getting in from work. And I just used to look at my drinking as being a result of my living on the other side of the clock. Like I would start work at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd work till 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I would go to a booze can. Whereas other people, normal people, would start work at 8 o'clock in the morning, work till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe go to a bar, have supper or something like that, and then they'd drink in the evening. So I just lived on the other side of the clock, and I didn't see any lunatic kind of thing. I didn't see any problem with alcohol about that, when in fact it was a great problem. The other thing that was happening in my family is between my brothers and sisters, we were looking at family photographs. And our family had come from Montreal, moved to Toronto, and I know that there were several members of the family who had died because of alcoholism. We had one uncle who died under a bridge. He froze to death. But the question as kids was, well, you know, what happened to Uncle Joe? Well, he died under a bridge. Point final. No discussion. Nothing ever further was said about any of the alcoholic incidences in the family. I can say also for myself when I was 14 years old that I remember that I was in the militia for one day because that's all I could handle about authority. I signed the papers, I went and got the haircut, and the next day I went back and I resigned. But anyway, I had the haircut, my cousin was getting married, and so I went to this at 14 years old. And proceeded, my uncle, who was chief inspector on the Toronto Police Force, who had been in the Navy, said, well, if you're old enough to serve your country, you're old enough to drink for your country. So that was the first time I remember getting totally blotto at a family wedding, where my older brother had to keep me away from my grandmother by walking around the far side of the building. Every time my grandmother was looking, oh, where's Ted? Where's Ted? And my brothers would have me on the other side. And oddly enough, I think that's probably happened to each one of my brothers, you know, that we had something like that happen at a family wedding. And maybe a lot of people have that happen at family weddings. But for me, I think it was another indication. I met a woman. I came down to Montreal and I met a woman here who we were involved for 1 year. And then she gave me an ultimatum. She says, you know, she says, Tio, you either move to Montreal or I move to Toronto. And I'm looking and I'm saying, well, I find Toronto is really boring. So I'm going to move to Montreal. Well, that was my first geographic cure, or first major geographic cure. I'd maybe had little ones in between that. And I thought to myself, no, I'm going to disconnect. I've really botched everything that I've done in Toronto. My family does not expect me to go to family parties without wearing sunglasses or without being snapped or without being obnoxious. I'd lost a lot of friends that I had in Toronto. The only people that I hung around with was drinking, you know, fair weather friends kind of thing. Maybe some of you folks are kind of familiar with that. The people that I tended to be with were also people where, you know, you could say that misery loves company. They put up with me because I put up with them, and then we could drink together. When I came here to Montreal, things did not get better. I was involved with this woman for a couple of years. It was not a good relationship. I would even say that I know now, as a recovered alcoholic, that the relationships that I had with the women that I knew, they were also users. They were also alcoholic. And they also had character defects which matched mine. So it was a very, very good fit. And I know from one of my friends that I've talked to about this, he says, yeah, we go to bars and there's like these little antenna that come up. And what we're looking around and how it is that, you know, we'll meet someone of the opposite sex or someone who interests us who has the same character defects, because I never wanted a woman to judge me and ever tell me that I couldn't drink or I couldn't drug. I wanted to be able to be my own person. So if I wasn't going to be there, if I was going to stand her up, if I was going to be some way less in the relationship than what was expected, I also had to allow her the same grace. You know, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander kind of thing. So I proceeded to try and develop my business here in Montreal. It cost me an awful lot of money. I was working in a particular kind of business where I took a lot of money out of my savings. I put it into the business, and the business was going nowhere. And all I could do was, again, you know, this mental obsession. From 9 o'clock in the morning, I'd be thinking about 10 o'clock at night when I could go and visit my neighbor and drink St. Ives. Now, I don't know if you folks know what St. Ives is, but it's about 9% malt liquor. It's not like the Kilkenny or the Guinness. I mean, I used to drink much finer stuff, but at a certain point, I just said, forget it, you know. I'm going for low test, or high test, rather, at low price. And this fellow, again, is somebody who was a fair weather friend. He would talk about political things. He would talk about things which I had no interest in. But I would put up with his talk because we were going to get drunk and we'd smoke a bit of reefer together, and he was my friend. One of the other telltale things that happened was that I was involved in a lot of community activism. I was out to save the world, because while I was saving the world, I wouldn't have to save Ted. I wouldn't have to deal with myself. So I was working on the municipal campaign with the current mayor, and at this point, I understand that in God's world, by the grace of God, things happen kind of, you know, I would say it's serendipitous. I mean, things happen like in God's universe, not by mistake, but more or less by God's plan. All these things started to happen that were all kind of lined up for me. So let me just go very quickly through what they were. First off, I used to go down to a small southwestern Ontario town and visit my younger brother when his wife would call my sisters and say, your brother is falling asleep drunk. What's going on here? And I'd go down to kind of calm, you know, because here's older brother. I'm a fine example. And actually, it was a bunch of I was a hypocrite, but I didn't know it at the time. I was just older brother. So I would go down there with my pockets full of reefer, and I'd take my brother out and get him pissed drunk and get him all smoked up and all whacked out. And of course, it wasn't doing anything for his marriage. I was contributing to the pain in his relationship. At the same time as saying, well, no, I'm just being older brother and I'm kind of helping out. Well, there was no help whatsoever. And years later, I was to understand that when my brother speaks about his marriage with his wife, he says, "My marriage was made in heaven." I said, "How so?" He says, "I'm a drinker. My wife is a controller. She tries to exert control, and I drink more." And so what they had to do as a couple was to learn how to change that dynamic. And they have. But what happened with my brother was that on a particular evening, his wife was stepping out, and he says to her, "Excuse me, but where are you going at night?" And she says, "I'm going to a meeting of alcoholics or of Al-Anon." And he says, "Well, isn't Al-Anon for the friends and relatives of alcoholics?" And she looks at him and says, "Yes, it is." And he says that the penny dropped for him. He realized that she was taking her commitment, her love, and her relationship with him very seriously, and she was not going to support his alcoholism any longer. She was detaching with love. As a result of that, I mean, my brother got into the program, and my brother was in the program before I was. And by the grace of God, this is what then happened, is that I'm working for this particular mayor at the moment. My brother phones me up one time and he says, "Listen, how are things going down there?" And I said, "Well, working my buns off on this campaign here and doing all this." My brother says, "Excuse me, are you getting paid for any of this?" I said, "No, I'm not getting paid." He said, "Well, what are you doing it for?" I said, "Well, the mayor loves me. He sees me, my brother says, "Listen, that's grandiosity, and that's a trait of an alcoholic." And of course, I'm saying, "Look, I smoke a little Johnny. I drink a little bit sometimes, but no, I'm not an alcoholic. Excuse me." So he says to me, "Listen, there's this book that I have, and I want to send this book to you in the mail, because I think you'd appreciate this book. And it's a book called, Is There an Alcoholic in the Closet?" So I get this book in the mail, and I'm reading through it, and my brother says to me, "Yeah, you read this book and you're going to understand me." So I'm getting through the book, and I'm getting through, "Yes, that's my brother, yes, that's my brother." I get halfway through the book, and then the guy starts talking about dual addiction, marijuana and alcohol. And I said, "Uh-oh, that's not my brother, that's me." And I said, "That SOB, he tricked me. He got me to read a book about alcoholism by telling me it was going to be about himself when actually it was about me." So as a result of that, one of the other things that was also happening concurrently in my life at that time was that at this business that I had a little party one evening, and there was a lady who dropped by it at this particular party. And I offered her a drink. She wouldn't have a drink. She says, "No, I'm a member of the fellowship." I said, "What fellowship's that?" So we got talking a little bit, and of course she explains that it's Alcoholics Anonymous. We dated for a little while, and when I would see her, out of respect for her, because I was just such a generous person, I wouldn't drink alcohol. Of course, I'd drink it every 5 minutes that I wasn't around her, but when I was with her and we went out for a date, I wouldn't drink. I'd smoke reefer. So finally, one time she looks at me and says, "You smell like a cow." I said, "Pardon me? I mean, this person is like, I'm 6'4", 260 pounds, this person is 5 feet tall." And she looks at me and says, "You smell like a cow. It comes out the pores of your skin. It's terrible. Why don't you stop that stuff? I mean, you're an alcoholic and you're a pothead. You got to do something." And I'm thinking, I'm looking at this person, and I mean, I don't know where she came from. I had another friend also that I used to go out on just occasions, when for business we would go with each other to some kind of event. So it was like I'd accompany her. And at this one particular time, she says, "You know what? When you don't drink, you're a very interesting guy. You're very intelligent. You're a nice guy. But when you have one beer," she says, "then you start to fade away into the wallpaper. And after like six beer, forget it. You have nothing intelligent to say. You're opinionated. You're boring." So here it is, within like 1 week, two people have said something to me. And I have to say that today I took some time just looking through my diary. And I looked at the dates that when I had first met this woman who told me that I smelled like a cow, to the time that I actually started going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, my first meeting was Acceptance, which happened to be her group. And it was by the fact that my brother had the heart and the love to tell me, "You've got problems with alcohol," to the point where these two people are challenging me, to the point where I'm leaving my neighbor's place one night at 2 o'clock in the morning after he's already gone to bed. And I'm watching Test Patterns on his TV and passed out there after drinking this wonderful St. Ives stuff. And I say, "Oh, I got to get upstairs because I've got to work tomorrow." which was wishful thinking, you know, because at this point people weren't happy to see me. People would just say to me, the clients I would go to see for venture capital and for business would just say, hey, Ted, good luck with all your projects, because I was just so mixed up. So this particular night, anyway, I'm leaving my neighbor's place and I'm going upstairs to my apartment and I tripped on the stairs. Now, if I had been going downstairs and I tripped, I wouldn't be here tonight. But the fact is that I was going upstairs and I almost bumped my nose on the tread of the stairs. And I laughed and I said, God help me. I mean, this is ridiculous. This is just, you know, I saw in front of me, I'd gone through all my friends, I'd gone through all my money, I'd gone through all my opportunities, and I was a piss tank. And all I could think about all day was 9% booze. And So I had also neglected to say that a year and a half before that time, I broke my ankle in a accident in the snow. It wasn't a ski thing. It was on a toboggan with a six-year-old. And it was just one of those kind of freak things. But I sat in my apartment, and I talked to this to my sisters and my family later. I was extremely suicidal. I could not move. It was in at Christmas time in the year 2001 when I broke my ankle. And I sat inside my apartment, and my neighbor would come by. She would buy beer for me. She would get reefer and roll up a couple of joints for me. And she would throw chocolate in the room, because chocolate was supposed to be an antidepressant. I wanted out. I wanted to check out. I wanted to kind of start all over again. And I thought maybe in my mind that, you know, if I was to end the whole thing, maybe somehow I could restart. And maybe I'd make a different decisions in my life. If I could just end the whole thing and start over again, maybe it wouldn't be such a mess. And by the grace of God, that's not what I did. I mean, not in that sense, not in a physical sense. But I am here to tell you that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we do start our life over again. So when I came into the program, as I say, my first meeting was at Acceptance at St. James Church down on St. Catherine. And I joined a home group, and then I started doing things at the home group. Like, I think at that point there was smoking outside, so you had to empty the little coffee thing with sand in it. But I started setting up for the meeting and making coffee. And I couldn't believe it, but these people gave me a key to the church. And I'm thinking to myself, our meeting is on Friday night, but I could go in the church any night of the week. What could I do in that church with this key? Probably not a lot, but I mean, that's my sick thinking, right? But just the fact that they had given me a key and I had the responsibility then to set up for this meeting. And having come from a place of such desperation and of such a sense of loss and nothingness and emptiness, to now being at a point where people are saying, no, you've got to read this book. You've got to go from, you've got to read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You need to get a sponsor. There are certain things that you need to do, but you also need to be accountable and you have to be responsible and you have to set up this meeting. So that's what I did. And then I by the grace of God, again, how things happen, I had been in the program for 2 years when I was away at an AA event. And if you take a look at page 119 of the 12 and 12, Bill Wilson wrote, when boy meets girl on the campus of an AA event and it's love at first sight, watch out. Well, I met a woman. I hadn't finished all the steps. I hadn't even gone through step 4, so I wasn't working the program. But I met this woman. And she was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're in recovery and we're okay. Well, no, it wasn't okay. It was like two sick people who had met each other, and by God, I had them, you know, I was blessed with having some friends who were very straightforward to me and just told me exactly how it was. I remember going away to work for a day with this one fellow, and he says, you know, our disease is a disease of perception. You think that you're involved with somebody, you think this person loves you, it's because you're projecting all these things. But what you need to do is to actually see the reality of where you're at and the relationship that you're in. And the other thing that was given to me was that I shouldn't be in a relationship at that point anyway. That as we know, that it's suggested that when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, it should be 2 years of applying ourselves to the program, applying the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous so that we move along and we develop a relationship with our higher power, then we can have a relationship with people. But I've been stonewalling, I've been stalling, but here it is, I'm in this relationship with this woman. Well, at the same time I was in this relationship, by coincidence, I was doing a 17-week 12-step workshop with a bunch of men. These were my stepbrothers. These are my stepbrothers. Now, what happened was that as I'm going through the steps and I'm getting to the moral inventory, I'm getting to sharing this with God, myself, and my sponsor. I'm getting to step 7, which is to ask God to take away these shortcomings. I was in such pain emotionally about this relationship that I was with this person that I had no problem in asking God. I said, God, I don't want to live like this anymore. I'm sick and tired of 35 years of living the way I have. I'm not a happy person. I'm an alcoholic. I have major problems and I need to be dealing with reality. And as a result of this, I was able to come into the program with a lot more strength and a lot more commitment than I would have if it was just a mental exercise. I have since that time done another 12-step workshop, another 17-week workshop with men. I go to retreats every couple of months. I try to do one event per month that has to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I am going later this month to the Ontario Regional Conference, where I will share a table at the banquet with my twin sister, my younger brother, my sister-in-law, and their two children. So it's a family table. And I have to tell you, the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous within a family, it is a very, very powerful thing to see. My nephews come up to me now. I've been in the program almost 5 years now. So they still will come up to me and they'll say, hey, Uncle Ted, are you still in that program or do you want to come up behind the barn kind of thing? I said, no, I'm still in the program. So at a family party, they may come up and they're kind of playing around. But I know on other times when I've seen them one-on-one that they've been honest enough with me to say, you know, maybe I have a problem about something here. And so I know that in talking to my brother and talking to my sisters, because the program of Alcoholics Anonymous now has kind of imprinted itself in our family. Just this last Christmas, I had one sister who's not in the program who says to me, are you still in Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, yes. She says, you're not drinking and you're not smoking? And I said, no, I'm not. And she says, you know, you're a fine example. And because of your example, I'm not drinking anymore. And I'm thinking to myself, my sister is a school teacher. I didn't even know that she had a problem. So this, you know, when we talk about attraction, not promotion, also the fact that my twin sister is not an alcoholic. She is a person who is curious about the fellowship so that she comes to our events, which is a wonderful thing again. I became a GSR, and again, what was happening was that, and I think you folks can relate to this, in coming to my bottom, I was humbled. And in being humbled, we're teachable. All of a sudden, I could open my ear to what somebody else had to say. They had life experience, they had knowledge which was much greater than mine, and I learned to listen. So in the home group where I am right now at Park Extension, there was a gentleman there, and I was asked if I would be GSR, which is the group service representative. And I said, yes, I would. Our particular group didn't have a GSR for a very long time, so I got involved in service from that point of view. So here it is. I'm going to the conferences. I'm going to workshops and retreats with the men. When I go to Toronto, this is what we talk about in my family. And I have to share with you just very quickly, over the Christmas holidays, again, you know, this character defect of the older brother, I'm with my younger brother in his town. And I said, listen, you know, since I'm here, how would you and your wife like to go out tonight? And I'll take care of the kids. You know, like they can go out and have an adult evening. And my brother looks at me and says, no, how about you come out with me to an AA meeting tonight, because that's what I do on Friday night. And my wife, she goes to Al-Anon. And the kids, they go to Alateen. So this is the Friday night that they have every Friday. This is their family dynamic now. And just very quickly, you know, how I guess it's the ego thing. My little niece says, well, Uncle Ted, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes, I am. She says, well, are you a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, yes, I am. She says, well, Daddy's an alcoholic too. And I said, yes, he is. And she says, but he's been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous longer than you, hasn't he? And I'm thinking, yeah. There's a whole ego thing for a little 10-year-old girl. Well, my daddy's more of an alcoholic than you, so. But the other wonderful thing is that my brother has already warned me. He says that at a certain point, this little girl says to him, Daddy, you used to get drunk with Uncle Ted and smoke also, didn't you? And my brother says, yes, I did. And so he's warned me. He says, this girl is going to be asking me, you know, what I did to furnish him with the drugs and the alcohol. And what my response would be right away, I know that I could say that misery loves company, because I could not stand to see the accomplishments that he had in his life, so I was trying to take him down to another level. I'm now the district committee member for our district. We have an awful lot of work to do. If any of you folks are not familiar with what happens at the service level, it's, as Karen had mentioned, there's four area assemblies a year. There are workshops. There's much, much opportunity for you to find out how the service works in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been a lesson for me. I work the telephone lines. We have public information. I do a regular meeting every week at in the prisons. And for the prisons, that is where the slogan, there but for the grace of God, comes to light for me, because I could have been one of those gentlemen who was in prison. And it was just that by happenstance I didn't get caught when I was doing something foolish, and so here I am this evening. It's a wonderful program. They talk, you know, also in the big book about our experience about the spiritual awakening. And I know that these things are happening in my life now because of service. That when we talk about doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not only that we're helping somebody in getting out of ourself and helping that other person, but there's also ways that I've started to see myself and to understand other people, which never would have happened had I not been working with other people. I'm challenged sometimes because I want to do it my way, and I realize I can't do that. I have to be open. There are no leaders in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I have to be open to the collective. I have to be open to working with other people. And so I'm constantly learning. And it's just this most fabulous thing now. I've arrived at a point now where I am now opening up to the abundance of what life has to offer. I used to never want to get up in the morning because all it was going to be was a bunch of problems all day long. And now I look at that not as problems, but as experience. And these gifts have all come to me because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've stopped, I've been able to stand in one place long enough and to see what is going on in my life and to be able to help other people. I'm very glad to be here this evening. Thank you very much for asking me to share. God bless all of you.